Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Cosmos, A Personal Voyage by Carl Sagan. Performed by LeVar Burton, Anne Druyan, Seth MacFarlane, and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hi, this is Anne Druyan. It was my great honor to be the creative director of NASA's Voyager Interstellar Message, the writer-producer of the Cosmos television series, and to think and write for 2 decades with my late husband, Carl Sagan. It is with enormous pleasure that I welcome you to the first audio edition of Carl's award-winning book, Cosmos. It was first published in 1980. As a companion to the award-winning PBS television series, Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, that Carl and I wrote with astronomer Steven Soter. Cosmos was the best-selling science book of its time, spending 70 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. A new edition of Cosmos was published in 2013 to coincide with the second season of the television series, Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. But in all that time, there was never an audiobook until now. So why now? Carl believed, as do I, that science belongs to everyone, not just because it reveals such a magnificent cosmos, but also because it is critical to our dreams of having a truly democratic society. Our civilization depends on science and high technology, and yet most of us are effectively excluded from the language, values, and methods of science. For us, that seemed then, and for me, even more so now, like a recipe for disaster. Audiobooks have become a growing medium in the publishing world and a powerful tool for literacy as well. Listening is reading, and the ear is proving to be as strong a pathway to the mind as the eye. That is the reason you are listening to Cosmos for the first time. Science is a permanent revolution. It never stops moving forward in its quest for a sharper, more accurate picture of reality. No single insight in this search is sacred. Only the searching. The decades that have passed since the publication of this book have been arguably the most eventful in the history of science. And yet, with a few exceptions, for example, in the precise age of the universe, this cosmos still stands up, not just as an accurate reflection of the grandeur of nature, but in many ways as a work of prophecy. The scientific community has arrived at consensus on climate change and on many of the ideas once deemed outrageously speculative contained herein. As you embark on this voyage, you'll be joining nearly a billion other of your fellow Earthlings in the great adventure of becoming a way for the cosmos to know itself and the next link in the generations of searchers.
For Anne Druyan, in the vastness of space and the immensity of time, it is my joy to share a planet and an epoch with Annie.
Reflections on Carl Sagan's Cosmos by me, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Not everyone who successfully impacts the hearts and minds of one generation will carry that currency of influence into the generations that follow. The continued success of Cosmos, Carl Sagan's magnum opus, argues strongly for Carl's affability and intelligence. But it also reveals a hidden hunger in us all to learn about our place in the universe and embrace why that matters intellectually, culturally, and emotionally. These properties distinguish the work of Carl Sagan and his collaborators from all other efforts to communicate science. Most good books in the genre teach you what to know in the author's field of expertise, what's hot, what's interesting, in clear and simple language. But rarely is that information shaped into knowledge. And even more rarely is that knowledge shaped into wonder, the foundation of a cosmos perspective on the world. Dare I assert that cosmos wielded this power in ways that profoundly influenced how we would observe, interpret, and conduct our lives? One of the least noted facts about cosmos, but perhaps its most significant gift to human culture, is how it repeatedly cross-pollinated traditional sciences: astronomy, biology, chemistry, geology. When taken separately, each of these fields is noble and time-honored. But when taken together, when cosmos wove them into a tapestry of insight on our place in the universe, their juxtaposition became potent and indelible. Cosmos was early, if not first, in this endeavor. In the decades that followed its publication, we would see the rise of hybrid fields of study, such as astrobiology, astroparticle physics, astrochemistry, planetary geology, some still donning their hyphens. But the publication and best-selling success of Cosmos accomplished much more than this. The book's treatment of scientific topics was persistently blended with other traditional fields of study, such as history, anthropology, art, and philosophy, to reveal for the first time how and why readers should embrace all the ways that science matters in our culture. At the time, there was nothing fresher, more uplifting, or more empowering than the themes and messages of Cosmos. Perhaps for the first time in any medium, the person teaching you science, Carl Sagan, cared about the tangled mental roadways that can rob a person of rational thought. His motif was to speak with you, not lecture at you. With that level of pedagogical comfort, millions of people around the world invited his television image into their living rooms and his printed words into their reading chairs. When Cosmos first arrived in 1980, the arms race of the Cold War was fading, but nonetheless continued to hold hostage the world's nations with a nuclear arsenal of destructive powers derived from the minds of physicists. But exploration was not without hope. NASA had already landed Viking on Mars, 7 years after we walked on the moon, and the twin Voyager space probes continued their flyby tour of the Jovian planets, on their way out of the solar system altogether. All headline news, but much more was to come. The space shuttle had not yet flown. The International Space Station existed only on paper. The Hubble Space Telescope was 11 years from launch. The first exoplanets, worlds orbiting suns other than our own, were 15 years from detection. The World Wide Web was still a decade from becoming a household utility, democratizing access to cosmic discoveries, and dozens more space missions would launch and arrive at their respective destinations. In a field that moves as rapidly as astrophysics, one would think it impossible to write a timeless tract on it. But within Cosmos, you're never focused on the bleeding edge of science. That comes and goes. You're instead treated to what the epic adventure of scientific inquiry means to Earth, to our species, to you. And that recipe works at any time, in any place, for any generation.
Foreword, written and read by Anne Trian. I once stood on the shores of the cosmic ocean with Carl Sagan. 35 years ago, we shivered in the sunshine on the wind-whipped Monterey cliffs of Northern California's Pacific Coast with our co-writer, astronomer Stephen Soder, and a small television crew. It was a struggle to wrangle the wildly flapping 2-foot-long galley pages of this book while trying to keep hold of the cardboard cue cards that Steve and I had prepared for Carl for the television show. The book and its original 1980 companion television series were created simultaneously in a 3-year-long frenzy, although each contains passages and sequences not found in the other. The pages of script and manuscript were one of a kind back in those relatively low-tech days. With every gust coming off the light-dazzled waves, the pages threatened to take flight and blow out to sea, like the dandelion puffballs Carl kept releasing to the cosmos. The scenes we wrote and shot that day became the opening of the show and the first words of the book. The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. We were consciously going for a biblical cadence, words that would scope out the ambitious territorial range of our explorations in space and time, beginning the saga of 40,000 generations of searchers on one tiny world, trying to find their bearings in the cosmos, required nothing less than an epic flourish. It became the welcome aboard to a personal voyage on the ship of the imagination, one that nearly a billion people have taken, and still take in great numbers, in virtually every language spoken on our pale blue dot. Ever since the fall of 1980, in both its manifestations, Cosmos has carried multitudes to the outermost reaches of our understanding of the universe, to places unimaginably small and incomprehensibly vast. Some religious fundamentalists found that first line offensive. To them, it was a shot across their bow that Carl was out to steal their thunder. They were onto something. As with everything Carl wrote, the science of cosmos is solid, with big red rhetorical flags warning the reader when the author ventures into the speculative. And 35 years later, how astonishingly prophetic have been most of Carl's conjectures on everything from climate change on Earth, the ambiguities of the Viking lander's findings on Mars, to his dreams of what might await us on Saturn's moon Titan. But Carl didn't stop there. The universe revealed by the relentless error-correcting mechanism of science was to him infinitely preferable to the untested assumptions of traditional belief. For Carl, the spiritual had to be rooted in natural reality. He cherished those ideas about the cosmos that remained after the most rigorous experiment and observation. Scientific insight made him feel something, a soaring sensation, a recognition that he could only compare to falling in love. And as he used to say, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. This is the big, wide-open, welcoming embrace of cosmos, as far from the clock-watching slow-death tedium of too many a science class as Titan is from Earth. It's about being unafraid to take the findings of science to heart. Cosmos is for many that first encounter with the universe that you thought was foreclosed to you because you couldn't do the math, or you live in a place where there are no scientists to invite you in. Carl wanted everyone to come on this voyage to experience the power of the scientific perspective and the wonders it reveals. His secret was to recapture the person he was before he understood the concept and then retrace his own thought steps toward comprehension. It worked. He inspired legions to study, teach, and do science. The U.S. Library of Congress has recently designated Cosmos one of the 88 books that shaped America. It's a roster that includes such earth-shaking works as Thomas Paine's Common Sense, Herman Melville's Moby Dick, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Jack Kerouac's On the Road. They're listed in chronological order, and the very first one, published in 1751, decades before the concept of a constitutional government by, for, and of the people crystallized, is also a science book. It's by another who believed that democracy requires an informed public of responsible decision makers. The list begins with Benjamin Franklin's Experiments and Observations on Electricity. That book, and this one, are passionate acts of citizenship by two scientists who wanted science to belong to all of us. This spring, I returned for the first time to the shores of the cosmic ocean. I was there with another television crew to shoot the opening scenes of the new Cosmos series. Our host, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, is one of the many scientists whose young lives were touched by Carl. I'm happy to report that the terrain is as unspoiled, gorgeous, and inspiring as it was the first time. As I looked out at the glittering waters of the Pacific, I was seeing for Carl. He knew that it's not for any one generation to see the completed picture. That's the point. The picture is never completed. There is always so much more that remains to be discovered. Welcome aboard. It's time once again to set sail for the stars.
Introduction, read by Seth MacFarlane. The time will come when diligent research over long periods will bring to light things which now lie hidden. A single lifetime, even though entirely devoted to the sky, would not be enough for the investigation of so vast a subject. And so this knowledge will be unfolded only through long successive ages. There will come a time when our descendants will be amazed that we did not know the things that are so plain to them. Many discoveries are reserved for ages still to come, when memory of us will have been effaced. Our universe is a sorry little affair unless it has in it something for every age to investigate. Nature does not reveal her mysteries once and for all. Seneca, Natural Questions, Book 7, 1st Century. In ancient times, in everyday speech and custom, the most mundane happenings were connected with the grandest cosmic events. A charming example is an incantation against the worm which the Assyrians of 1000 BC imagined to cause toothaches. It begins with the origin of the universe and ends with a cure for toothache. After Anu had created the heaven, and the heaven had created the earth, and the earth had created the rivers, and the rivers had created the canals, and the canals had created the morass, and the morass had created the worm went before Shamash, weeping, his tears flowing before Ea. What wilt thou give me for my food? What wilt thou give me for my drink? I will give thee the dried fig and the apricot. What are these to me, the dried fig and the apricot? Lift me up, and among the teeth and the gums let me dwell. Because thou hast said this, O worm, may Ea smite thee with the might of his hand. Incantation against toothache. Its treatment, second-grade beer and oil thou shalt mix together. The incantation thou shalt recite 3 times thereon, and shalt put the medicine upon the tooth. Our ancestors were eager to understand the world, but had not quite stumbled upon the method. They imagined a small, quaint, tidy universe in which the dominant forces were gods like Anu, Ea, and Shamash. In that universe, humans played an important, if not a central, role. We were intimately bound up with the rest of nature. The treatment of a toothache with second-rate beer was tied to the deepest cosmological mysteries. Today, we have discovered a powerful and elegant way to understand the universe, a method called science. It has revealed to us a universe so ancient and so vast that human affairs seem at first sight to be of little consequence. We have grown distant from the cosmos. It has seemed remote and irrelevant to everyday concerns. But science has found not only that the universe has a reeling and ecstatic grandeur, not only that it is accessible to human understanding, but also that we are, in a very real and profound sense, a part of that cosmos, born from it, our fate deeply connected with it. The most basic human events and the most trivial trace back to the universe and its origins. This book is devoted to the exploration of that cosmic perspective. In the summer and fall of 1976, as a member of the Viking Lander imaging flight team, I was engaged with 100 of my scientific colleagues in the exploration of the planet Mars. For the first time in human history,
we had landed two space vehicles on the surface of another world. The results, described more fully in Chapter 5, were spectacular, the historical significance of the mission utterly apparent. And yet, the general public was learning almost nothing of these great happenings. The press was largely inattentive. Television ignored the mission almost altogether. When it became clear that a definitive answer on whether there is life on Mars would not be forthcoming, interest dwindled still further. There was little tolerance for ambiguity. When we found the sky of Mars to be a kind of pinkish yellow rather than the blue which had erroneously first been reported, the announcement was greeted by a chorus of good-natured boos from the assembled reporters. They wanted Mars to be, even in this respect, like the Earth. They believed that their audiences would be progressively disinterested as Mars was revealed to be less and less like the Earth. And yet the Martian landscapes are staggering, the vistas breathtaking. I was positive, from my own experience, that an enormous global interest exists in the exploration of the planets and in many kindred scientific topics. The origin of life, the Earth, and the cosmos, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, our connection with the universe. And I was certain that this interest could be excited through that most powerful communications medium, television. The Cosmos television series and this book represent a hopeful experiment in communicating some of the ideas, methods, and joys of science. The book and the television series evolve together. In some sense, each is based on the other. Many illustrations in this book are based on the striking visuals prepared for the television series. But books and television series have somewhat different audiences and admit differing approaches. One of the great virtues of a book is that it is possible for the reader to return repeatedly to obscure or difficult passages. This is only beginning to become possible with the development of videotape and video disc technology for television. There is much more freedom for the author in choosing the range and depth of topics for a chapter in a book than for the Procrustean 58 minutes, 30 seconds of a non-commercial television program. This book goes more deeply into many topics than does the television series. There are topics discussed in the book which are not treated in the television series and vice versa. For example, explicit representations of the cosmic calendar featured in the television series do not appear here, in part because the cosmic calendar is discussed in my book, The Dragons of Eden. Likewise, I do not here discuss the life of Robert Goddard in much detail, because there is a chapter in Broca's Brain devoted to him. But each episode of the television series follows fairly closely the corresponding chapter of this book, and I like to think that the pleasure of each will be enhanced by reference to the other. For clarity, I have in a number of cases introduced an idea more than once, the first time lightly, and with deeper passes on subsequent appearances. This occurs, for example, in the introduction to cosmic objects in Chapter 1, which are examined in greater detail later on, or in the discussion of mutations, enzymes, and nucleic acids in Chapter 2. In a few cases, concepts are presented out of historical order. For example, the ideas of the ancient Greek scientists are presented in Chapter 7, well after the discussion of Johannes Kepler in Chapter 3. But I believe an appreciation of the Greeks can best be provided after we see what they barely missed achieving. Because science is inseparable from the rest of the human endeavor, it cannot be discussed without making contact, sometimes glancing, sometimes head-on, with a number of social, political, religious, and philosophical issues. Even in the filming of a television series on science, the worldwide devotion to military activities becomes intrusive. Simulating the exploration of Mars in the Mojave Desert with a full-scale version of the Viking lander, we were repeatedly interrupted by the United States Air Force performing bombing runs in a nearby test range. In Alexandria, Egypt, from 9 to 11 a.m. every morning, our hotel was the subject of practice strafing runs by the Egyptian Air Force. In Samos, Greece, permission to film anywhere was withheld until the very last moment, because of NATO maneuvers and what was clearly the construction of a warren of underground and hillside emplacements for artillery and tanks. In Czechoslovakia, the use of walkie-talkies for organizing the filming logistics on a rural road attracted the attention of a Czech Air Force fighter which circled overhead until reassured in Czech that no threat to national security was being perpetrated. In Greece, Egypt, and Czechoslovakia, our film crews were accompanied everywhere by agents of the state security apparatus. Preliminary inquiries about filming in Kaluga, USSR, for a proposed discussion of the life of the Russian pioneer of astronautics, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, were discouraged, because, as we later discovered, trials of dissidents were to be conducted there. Our camera crews met innumerable kindnesses in every country we visited, but the global military presence, the fear in the hearts of the nations, was everywhere. The experience confirmed my resolve to treat, when relevant, social questions both in the series and in the book. Science is an ongoing process. It never ends. There is no single ultimate truth to be achieved, after which all the scientists can retire. And because this is so, the world is far more interesting both for the scientists and for the millions of people in every nation who, while not professional scientists, are deeply interested in the methods and findings of science. So while there is little in the Cosmos book that has become obsolete since its first publication, there have been many significant new findings. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft encountered the Saturn system and uncovered a host of wonders concerning the planet, its intricate ring system, and its swarm of attendant satellites. Perhaps the most interesting of these is Titan, which is now known to have an atmosphere rather like that of the primitive Earth, a dense haze layer composed of complex organic molecules, and perhaps a surface ocean of liquid hydrocarbons. A range of observations have recently been made of rings of debris surrounding young stars. These rings may be in the process of coagulating into new planetary systems and suggest that planets may be overwhelmingly abundant among the stars of the Milky Way galaxy. Life has been found unexpectedly nibbling on sulfur compounds in very high temperature vents on the Earth's ocean floor. New evidence has accumulated suggesting that comets are periodically sprayed into the inner solar system, triggering the extinction of many species on Earth. Great regions of intergalactic space have been uncovered that seemingly are depleted in galaxies. New and important components of the universe bearing on the question of its ultimate fate have been suggested. And the pace of discovery continues. Spacecraft of Japan, for the European Space Agency, and of the Soviet Union are scheduled to intercept Halley's Comet in 1986. The U.S. Space Telescope, the largest orbiting observatory ever attempted, is scheduled to be launched before the end of the decade. Important opportunities for spacecraft missions to Mars, to other comets, to asteroids, and to Titan are emerging. The U.S. Galileo spacecraft, scheduled to arrive in the Jupiter system in 1988, is designed to drop the first entry probe into the atmosphere of one of the giant planets. And there is a somber side to the pace of scientific discovery as well. Recent work suggests that in the aftermath of a nuclear war, the resulting soot and dust lofted high into the atmosphere would darken and freeze the Earth, producing an unprecedented catastrophe even for nations on which not a single bomb has fallen. Our technology is increasingly permitting us to explore the wonders of the cosmos and to reduce the Earth to chaos. We are privileged to live in, and if we are lucky, to influence, one of the most critical epochs in the history of the human species. My greatest debt for the writing of Cosmos is owed to Andrianne and to Steven Soder, my co-writers in the television series. They made fundamental and frequent contributions to the basic ideas and their connections, to the overall intellectual structure of the episodes, and to the felicity of style. I am deeply grateful for their vigorous, critical readings of early versions of this book, their constructive and creative suggestions for revision through many drafts, and their major contributions to the television script, in which many ways influence the content of this book. The delight I found in our many discussions is one of my chief rewards from the Cosmos Project. Carl Sagan, Ithaca and Los Angeles, May 1980 and July 1984.
Chapter 1, The Shores of the Cosmic Ocean. The first men to be created and formed were called the Sorcerer of Fatal Laughter, the Sorcerer of Night, Unkempt, and the Black Sorcerer. They were endowed with intelligence. They succeeded in knowing all that there is in the world. When they looked, instantly they saw all that is around them, and they contemplated in turn the arc of heaven and the round face of the earth. Then the Creator said, "They know all. What shall we do with them now? Let their sight reach only to that which is near. Let them see only a little of the face of the earth. Are they not by nature simple creatures of our making? Must they also be gods?" The Popol Vuh of the K'iche Maya. The known is finite, the unknown infinite. Intellectually, we stand on an islet in the midst of an illimitable ocean of inexplicability. Our business in every generation is to reclaim a little more land. T.H. Huxley, 1887. The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be. Our feeblest contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There is a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries. The size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding. Lost somewhere between immensity and eternity is our tiny planetary home. In a cosmic perspective, most human concerns seem insignificant, even petty. And yet, our species is young and curious and brave and shows much promise. In the last few millennia, we have made the most astonishing and unexpected discoveries about the cosmos and our place within it, explorations that are exhilarating to consider. They remind us that humans have evolved to wonder, that understanding is a joy, that knowledge is prerequisite to survival. I believe our future depends on how well we know this cosmos in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. Those explorations required skepticism and imagination both. Imagination will often carry us to worlds that never were, but without it, we go nowhere. Skepticism enables us to distinguish fancy from fact, to test our speculations. The cosmos is rich beyond measure in elegant facts, in exquisite interrelationships, in the subtle machinery of awe. The surface of the earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. From it, we have learned most of what we know. Recently, we have waded a little out to sea, enough to dampen our toes or, at most, wet our ankles. The water seems inviting. The ocean calls. Some part of our being knows this is from where we came. We long to return. These aspirations are not, I think, irreverent, although they may trouble whatever gods may be. The dimensions of the cosmos are so large that using familiar units of distance, such as meters or miles, chosen for their utility on Earth, would make little sense. Instead, we measure distance with the speed of light. In 1 second, a beam of light travels 186,000 miles, nearly 300,000 kilometers, or 7 times around the Earth. In 8 minutes, it will travel from the Sun to the Earth. We can say the Sun is 8 light minutes away. In a year, it crosses nearly 10 trillion kilometers, about 6 trillion miles of intervening space. That unit of length, the distance light goes in a year, is called a light year. It measures not time, but distances, enormous distances. The Earth is a place. It is by no means the only place. It is not even a typical place. No planet or star or galaxy can be typical because the cosmos is mostly empty. The only typical place is within the vast, cold, universal vacuum, the everlasting night of intergalactic space, a place so strange and desolate that by comparison, planets and stars and galaxies seem achingly rare and lovely. If we were randomly inserted into the cosmos, the chance that we would find ourselves on or near a planet would be less than 1 in 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 10 to the 33rd power, a 1 followed by 33 zeros. In everyday life, such odds are called compelling. Worlds are precious. From an intergalactic vantage point, we would see, strewn like sea froth on the waves of space, innumerable faint, wispy tendrils of light. These are the galaxies. Some are solitary wanderers, most inhabit communal clusters, huddling together, drifting endlessly in the great cosmic dark. Before us is the cosmos on the grandest scale we know. We are in the realm of the nebulae, 8 billion light years from Earth, halfway to the edge of the known universe. A galaxy is composed of gas and dust and stars, billions upon billions of stars. Every star may be a sun to someone. Within a galaxy are stars and worlds, and it may be a proliferation of living things and intelligent beings and spacefaring civilizations. But from afar, a galaxy reminds me more of a collection of lovely found objects, seashells perhaps, or corals, the productions of nature laboring for eons in the cosmic ocean. There are some 100 billion, 10 to the 11th power, galaxies, each with, on the average, 100 billion stars. In all the galaxies, there are perhaps as many planets as stars, 10 to the 11th power times 10 to the 11th power equaling 10 to the 22nd power, 10 billion trillion. In the face of such overpowering numbers, what is the likelihood that only one ordinary star, the Sun, is accompanied by an inhabited planet? Why should we, tucked away in some forgotten corner of the cosmos, be so fortunate? To me, it seems far more likely that the universe is brimming over with life. But we humans do not yet know. We are just beginning our explorations. From 8 billion light years away, we are hard-pressed to find even the cluster in which our Milky Way galaxy is embedded, much less the Sun or the Earth. The only planet we are sure is inhabited is a tiny speck of rock and metal, shining feebly by reflected sunlight, and at this distance, utterly lost. But presently, our journey takes us to what astronomers on Earth like to call the local group of galaxies. Several million light years across, it is composed of some 20 constituent galaxies. It is a sparse and obscure and unpretentious cluster. One of these galaxies is M31, seen from the Earth in the constellation Andromeda. Like other spiral galaxies, it is a huge pinwheel of stars, gas, and dust. M31 has two small satellites, dwarf elliptical galaxies bound to it by gravity, by the identical law of physics that tends to keep me in my chair. The laws of nature are the same throughout the cosmos. We are now 2 million light years from home. Beyond M31 is another very similar galaxy, our own, its spiral arms turning slowly once every quarter billion years. Now, 40,000 light-years from home, we find ourselves falling toward the massive center of the Milky Way. But if we wish to find the Earth, we must redirect our course to the remote outskirts of the galaxy, to an obscure locale near the edge of a distant spiral arm. Our overwhelming impression, even between the spiral arms, is of stars streaming by us. A vast array of exquisitely self-luminous stars, some as flimsy as a soap bubble and so large that they could contain 10,000 suns or a trillion Earths. Others the size of a small town and 100 trillion times denser than lead. Some stars are solitary, like the Sun. Most have companions. Systems are commonly double, two stars orbiting one another. But there is a continuous gradation from triple systems through loose clusters of a few dozen stars to the great globular clusters, resplendent with a million suns. Some double stars are so close that they touch and star stuff flows between them. Most are as separated as Jupiter is from the Sun. Some stars, the supernovae, are as bright as the entire galaxy that contains them. Others, the black holes, are invisible from a few kilometers away. Some shine with a constant brightness. Others flicker uncertainly or blink with an unfaltering rhythm. Some rotate in stately elegance. Others spin so feverishly that they distort themselves to oblateness. Most shine mainly in visible and infrared light. Others are also brilliant sources of X-rays or radio waves. Blue stars are hot and young. Yellow stars, conventional and middle-aged. Red stars, often elderly and dying. And small white or black stars are in the final throes of death. The Milky Way contains some 400 billion stars of all sorts, moving with a complex and orderly grace. Of all the stars, the inhabitants of Earth know close up so far but one. Each star system is an island in space, quarantined from its neighbors by the light years. I can imagine creatures evolving into glimmerings of knowledge on innumerable worlds, every one of them assuming at first their puny planet and paltry few suns to be all that is. We grow up in isolation. Only slowly do we teach ourselves the cosmos. Some stars may be surrounded by millions of lifeless and rocky worldlets, planetary systems frozen at some early stage in their evolution. Perhaps many stars have planetary systems rather like our own. At the periphery, great gaseous-ringed planets and icy moons, and nearer to the center, small, warm, blue-white cloud-covered worlds. On some, intelligent life may have evolved, reworking the planetary surface in some massive engineering enterprise. These are our brothers and sisters in the cosmos. Are they very different from us? What is their form, biochemistry, neurobiology, history, politics, science, technology, art, music, religion, philosophy? Perhaps someday we will know them. We have now reached our own backyard, a light year from Earth. Surrounding our sun is a spherical swarm of giant snowballs composed of ice and rock and organic molecules, the cometary nuclei. Every now and then, a passing star gives a tiny gravitational tug, and one of them obligingly careens into the inner solar system. There, the sun heats it, the ice is vaporized, and a lovely cometary tail develops. We approach the planets of our system, largish worlds, captives of the sun, gravitationally constrained to follow nearly circular orbits heated mainly by sunlight. Pluto, covered with methane ice and accompanied by its solitary giant moon Charon, is illuminated by a distant sun, which appears as no more than a bright point of light in a pitch-black sky. The giant gas worlds, Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, the jewel of the solar system, and Jupiter all have an entourage of icy moons. Interior to the region of gassy planets and orbiting icebergs are the warm, rocky provinces of the inner solar system. There is, for example, the red planet Mars, with soaring volcanoes, great rift valleys, enormous planet-wide sandstorms, and just possibly some simple forms of life. All the planets orbit the sun, the nearest star, an inferno of hydrogen and helium gas engaged in thermonuclear reactions, flooding the solar system with light. Finally, at the end of all our wanderings, we return to our tiny, fragile, blue-white world, lost in a cosmic ocean vast beyond our most courageous imaginings. It is a world among an immensity of others. It may be significant only for us. The Earth is our home, our parent. Our kind of life arose and evolved here. The human species is coming of age here. It is on this world that we developed our passion for exploring the cosmos. And it is here that we are in some pain and with no guarantees, working out our destiny. Welcome to the planet Earth, a place of blue nitrogen skies, oceans of liquid water, cool forests, and soft meadows, a world positively rippling with life. In the cosmic perspective, it is, as I have said, poignantly beautiful and rare. but it is also, for the moment, unique. In all our journeying through space and time, it is, so far, the only world on which we know with certainty that the matter of the cosmos has become alive and aware. There must be many such worlds scattered through space, but our search for them begins here, with the accumulated wisdom of the men and women of our species garnered at great cost over a million years. We are privileged to live among brilliant and passionately inquisitive people, and in a time when the search for knowledge is generally prized. Human beings, born ultimately of the stars and now for a while inhabiting a world called Earth, have begun their long voyage home. The discovery that the Earth is a little world was made, as so many important human discoveries were, in the ancient Near East, at a time some humans call the 3rd century BC, in the greatest metropolis of the age, the Egyptian city of Alexandria. Here there lived a man named Eratosthenes. One of his envious contemporaries called him Beta, the second letter of the Greek alphabet, because, he said, Eratosthenes was second best in the world in everything. But it seems clear that in almost everything, Eratosthenes was alpha. He was an astronomer, historian, geographer, philosopher, poet, theater critic, and mathematician. The titles of the books he wrote range from Astronomy to On Freedom from Pain. He was also the director of the Great Library of Alexandria, where one day he read in a papyrus book that in the southern frontier outpost of Syene, near the first cataract of the Nile, at noon on June 21st, vertical sticks cast no shadows. On the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, as the hours crept toward midday, the shadows of temple columns grew shorter. At noon, they were gone. A reflection of the sun could then be seen in the water at the bottom of a deep well. The sun was directly overhead. It was an observation that someone else might easily have ignored. Sticks, shadows, reflections in wells, the position of the sun, of what possible importance could such simple everyday matters be? But Eratosthenes was a scientist, and his musings on these commonplaces changed the world. In a way, they made the world. Eratosthenes had the presence of mind to do an experiment, actually to observe whether in Alexandria vertical sticks cast shadows near noon on June 21st, and he discovered sticks do. Eratosthenes asked himself how, at the same moment a stick in Syene could cast no shadow and a stick in Alexandria far to the north could cast a pronounced shadow. Consider a map of ancient Egypt with two vertical sticks of equal length, one stuck in Alexandria, the other in Syene. Suppose that at a certain moment, each stick casts no shadow at all. This is perfectly easy to understand, provided the earth is flat. The sun would then be directly overhead. If the two sticks cast shadows of equal length, that also would make sense on a flat earth. The sun's rays would then be inclined at the same angle to the two sticks. But how could it be that at the same instant there was no shadow at Syene and a substantial shadow at Alexandria? The only possible answer, he saw, was that the surface of the earth is curved. Not only that, the greater the curvature, the greater the difference in the shadow lengths. The sun is so far away that its rays are parallel when they reach the earth. Sticks placed at different angles to the sun's rays cast shadows of different lengths. For the observed difference in the shadow lengths, the distance between Alexandria and Syene had to be about 7 degrees along the surface of the earth. That is, if you imagine the sticks extending down to the center of the earth, they would there intersect at an angle of 7 degrees. 7 degrees is something like 1/50th of 360 degrees, the full circumference of the earth. Eratosthenes knew that the distance between Alexandria and Syene was approximately 800 kilometers because he hired a man to pace it out. 800 kilometers times 50 is 40,000 kilometers. So, that must be the circumference of the Earth. Or, if you like to measure things in miles, the distance between Alexandria and Cyene is about 500 miles, and 500 miles times 50 equals 25,000 miles. This is the right answer. Eratosthenes' only tools were sticks, eyes, feet, and brains, plus a taste for experiment. With them, he deduced the circumference of the Earth with an error of only a few percent, a remarkable achievement for 2,200 years ago. He was the first person accurately to measure the size of a planet. The Mediterranean world at that time was famous for seafaring. Alexandria was the greatest seaport on the planet. Once you knew the Earth to be a sphere of modest diameter, would you not be tempted to make voyages of exploration? To seek out undiscovered lands, perhaps even to attempt to sail around the planet? 400 years before Eratosthenes, Africa had been circumnavigated by a Phoenician fleet in the employ of the Egyptian pharaoh Necho. They set sail, probably in frail open boats from the Red Sea, turned down the east coast of Africa up into the Atlantic, returning through the Mediterranean. This epic journey took 3 years, about as long as a modern Voyager spacecraft takes to fly from Earth to Saturn. After Eratosthenes' discovery, many great voyages were attempted by brave and venturesome sailors. Their ships were tiny. They had only rudimentary navigational instruments. They used dead reckoning and followed coastlines as far as they could. In an unknown ocean, they could determine their latitude, but not their longitude, by observing night after night the position of the constellations with respect to the horizon. The familiar constellations must have been reassuring in the midst of an unexplored ocean. The stars are the friends of explorers. Then with seagoing ships on Earth and now with spacefaring ships in the sky. After Eratosthenes, some may have tried, but not until the time of Magellan did anyone succeed in circumnavigating the Earth. What tales of daring and adventure must earlier have been recounted as sailors and navigators, practical men of the world, gambled their lives on the mathematics of a scientist from Alexandria. In Eratosthenes' time, globes were constructed portraying the Earth as viewed from space. They were essentially correct in the well-explored Mediterranean, but became more and more inaccurate the farther they strayed from home. Our present knowledge of the cosmos shares this disagreeable but inevitable feature. In the first century, the Alexandrian geographer Strabo wrote, "Those who have returned from an attempt to circumnavigate the Earth do not say they have been prevented by an opposing continent, for the sea remained perfectly open, but rather through want of resolution and scarcity of provision." Eratosthenes says that if the extent of the Atlantic Ocean were not an obstacle, we might easily pass by sea from Iberia to India. It is quite possible that in the temperate zone there may be one or two habitable Earths. Indeed, if this other part of the world is inhabited, it is not inhabited by men such as exist in our parts, and we should have to regard it as another inhabited world. Humans were beginning to venture in almost every sense that matters to other worlds. The subsequent exploration of the Earth was a worldwide endeavor, including voyages from as well as to China and Polynesia. The culmination was, of course, the discovery of America by Christopher Columbus and the journeys of the following few centuries, which completed the geographical exploration of the Earth. Columbus's first voyage is connected in the most straightforward way with the calculations of Eratosthenes. Columbus was fascinated by what he called the Enterprise of the Indies, a project to reach Japan, China, and India, not by following the coastline of Africa and sailing east, but rather by plunging boldly into the unknown Western Ocean, or, as Eratosthenes had said with startling prescience, to pass by sea from Iberia to India. Columbus had been an itinerant peddler of old maps and an assiduous reader of the books by and about the ancient geographers, including Eratosthenes, Strabo, and Ptolemy. But for the enterprise of the Indies to work, for ships and crews to survive the long voyage, the Earth had to be smaller than Eratosthenes had said. Columbus therefore cheated on his calculations, as the examining faculty of the University of Salamanca quite correctly pointed out. He used the smallest possible circumference of the Earth and the greatest eastward extension of Asia he could find in all the books available to him, and then exaggerated even those. Had the Americas not been in the way, Columbus's expeditions would have failed utterly. The Earth is now thoroughly explored. It no longer promises new continents or lost lands, but the technology that allowed us to explore and inhabit the most remote regions of the Earth now permit us to leave our planet, to venture into space, to explore other worlds. Leaving the Earth, we are now able to view it from above, to see its solid spherical shape of Eratosthenian dimensions and the outlines of its continents, confirming that many of the ancient mapmakers were remarkably competent. What a pleasure such a view would have given to Eratosthenes and the other Alexandrian geographers. It was in Alexandria, during the 600 years beginning around 300 BC, that human beings, in an important sense, began the intellectual adventure that has led us to the shores of space. But of the look and feel of that glorious marble city, nothing remains. Oppression and the fear of learning have obliterated almost all memory of ancient Alexandria. Its population was marvelously diverse. Macedonian and later Roman soldiers, Egyptian priests, Greek aristocrats, Phoenician sailors, Jewish merchants, visitors from India and sub-Saharan Africa, everyone, except the vast slave population, lived together in harmony and mutual respect for most of the period of Alexandria's greatness. The city was founded by Alexander the Great and constructed by his former bodyguard. Alexander encouraged respect for alien cultures and the open-minded pursuit of knowledge. According to tradition, and it does not much matter whether it really happened, he descended beneath the Red Sea in the world's first diving bell. He encouraged his generals and soldiers to marry Persian and Indian women. He respected the gods of other nations. He collected exotic life forms, including an elephant for Aristotle, his teacher. His city was constructed on a lavish scale to be the world center of commerce, culture, and learning. It was graced with broad avenues, 30 meters wide, elegant architecture and statuary, Alexander's monumental tomb, an enormous lighthouse. The Pharos was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. But the greatest marvel of Alexandria was the library and its associated museum, literally an institution devoted to the specialties of the nine muses. Of that legendary library, the most that survives today is a dank and forgotten cellar of the Serapeum, the library annex, once a temple and later reconsecrated to knowledge. A few moldering shelves may be its only physical remains, yet this place was once the brain and glory of the greatest city on the planet, the first true research institute in the history of the world. The scholars of the library studied the entire cosmos. Cosmos is a Greek word for the order of the universe. It is, in a way, the opposite of chaos. It implies the deep interconnectedness of all things. It conveys awe for the intricate and subtle way in which the universe is put together. Here was a community of scholars exploring physics, literature, medicine, astronomy, geography, philosophy, mathematics, biology, and engineering, science, and scholarship had come of age. Genius flourished there. The Alexandrian Library is where we humans first collected seriously and systematically the knowledge of the world. In addition to Eratosthenes, there was the astronomer Hipparchus, who mapped the constellations and estimated the brightness of the stars. Euclid, who brilliantly systematized geometry and told his king, struggling over a difficult mathematical problem, "There is no royal road to geometry." Dionysius of Thrace, the man who defined the parts of speech and did for the study of language what Euclid did for geometry,